Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1978, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
On our desert island on this occasion is the composer and librettist Giancarlo Menotti. Mr. Menotti, would you rather have scores than discs on this island?
That is a rather difficult choice. I'm a very lazy reader of scores, so perhaps I would rather have a disc. I very seldom play discs because, just as I hate frozen food, I hate frozen music. And I feel that even the most marvelous piece of music, interpreted by the most marvelous interpreter, on repeated hearings, becomes very monotonous and irritating. Mm-hmm. Especially because I think that music depends very much on a spontaneous interpretation. It should change. That is why I think that if I were to choose, I know you're going to ask me for some discs to take with me. So I think that if I really were completely sincere, I think that the only discs I could stand to have with me and hearing again and again and again are discs of rather more abstract kind of music.
All right. What do we start with? What's the first?
I would like to start with one of my favorite composers of all times, which is Orlando di Lassus, a composer that I think has been a bit forgotten, and I don't think as appreciated as he should. Shall we start with something out of one of his masses?
Yes.
For example, the Kyrie from the Bell'Anfitrite d'Altera.
The Kyrie from the Missa Bell'Anfitrite d'Altera by Lassus, sung by the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, directed by Simon Preston. Whereabouts in Italy were you born?
I was born in a little village on the Lake of Lugano,
mm-hmm.
or overlooking the Lake of Lugano.
And I believe you took to music very early indeed.
Yes, I was one of those horrible enfants prodigues. I started music when I was 5 years old. I always knew I wanted to be a composer, so I had no troubles about choosing my career.
You were one of a large family, a large musical family.
Actually, my mother had 10 children. By the time I was born, 2 were already dead, so I grew up in a family of 8 children.
Yes.
It was actually a musical family, but none of them were professional musicians.
But you played chamber music at home?
Well, very often, yes. In the evening, my mother played the piano. I had one brother who played the cello. One played the violin. They all played, if I recall, rather abominably. They always took everything twice too slow, but they did get through in any Beethoven trio or Mozart trio.
What was your contribution?
I was then a little boy, and while my smaller brothers and sisters had to go to bed by, I think, 8 o'clock, if I remember, I was allowed to fall asleep in the music room. And so I used to fall asleep every night at the sound of Beethoven and Mozart, because my mother played badly, but she had a very good taste.
Good.
And she always surrounded me with good music.
You weren't far away from Milan, of course, so you went to La Scala?
Yes, I went to La Scala, but not until I was about 14. My father hated the city and kept us in the country all year round. So actually I didn't have a taste of the opera house until I was about 14.
By which time you'd already written a complete opera yourself.
Yes, I used to have a puppet theatre, and I used to write operas for my puppet theatre. Mm-hmm. And I wrote one opera called The Death of Pierrot, a very tragic work, at the end of which everybody's been either killed or died of natural death.
And you enrolled at the Milan Conservatory in due course. Composition, obviously. What was your other subject?
Well, at the conservatories we always did harmony and counterpoint and the usual thing.
The lot.
Piano and the lot. I was not a very good student, to tell you the truth.
Right, let's have your second record. What shall we have now?
Well, my second record is really, it's a very conventional choice, which is Bach. I would like to take the whole of the Well-Tempered Clavier.
One disc only.
Yes, but I mean, to the desert island, you let me take the whole of it, because I will
one
not take...
One disc only.
Or only one disc only. Oh, well, that's a very cruel choice. Well, then... Let us have, I mean, they're also beautiful, but what about the one in B-flat minor? I must confess something that will horrify some of your listeners. I love to hear my Well-Tempered on the piano rather than on the clavichord. I'm not a purist. And always the clavicembalo, more often than not, sounds to me like squash marmalade. That's horrible. So let me have a nice, clean piano. I'm sure that Bach would have been delighted to hear his own works on a nice pianoforte.
And who shall play it?
I've chosen the recording of Glenn Gould, which I think is a rather brilliant recording.
From Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, the Prelude and Fugue in B-flat minor played by Glenn Gould, or the opening of it at any rate. Well, they were at the Milan Conservatory, not doing very well, you said. In fact, your mother took you away because you weren't doing well enough. Is that so?
Yes, I was a rather lazy student, and my mother took me to Arturo Toscanini, who was more or less a friend of the family, and asked him what she should do with such a unruly student. And Toscanini advised her to take me away from Milano, away from the family, and to abandon me in a sort of desert island, which in this case turned out to be Philadelphia, which could very well be a desert island. you cannot imagine a duller place than Philadelphia. And then I was dumped by my mother at the age of 16, and I enrolled in the Curtis Institute of Music.
Did you speak English?
Well, the sort of English that I learned from my nurse, and which was really, it was very primitive indeed. So, as a matter of fact, the first thing I tried to buy in America, I wanted to have some nails to hang some pictures. And I thought of Chiodi in Italian, Clou in French, Clavos in Spanish. So I went into a hardware store and asked for some clouds, because I thought, that's the first thing I tried to buy in America, were clouds. I'm still trying to buy them.
Now, you were just, I think, 25 when you wrote your first opera, your first drone
actually,
opera.
I wrote it when I was 23, and then I think it was given by the school when I was 24, and then it was finally given a public performance when I was 25, yes.
That was Amelia Goes to the Ball.
Amelia Goes to the Ball.
And it was produced at the Metropolitan, New York, during two seasons?
Yes.
What did you follow it with?
After that, what did I write after that? I wrote the very first opera I ever written for wireless, which was called The Old Maid and the Thief,
yes,
which still is still alive and kicking.
And then The Island God.
Then The Island God, which was a tremendous disaster. No, actually, it was worse than a disaster. It was damned with fine praise.
But nevertheless, it played at the Met. And
Yes, it was done actually on a commission by the Metropolitan.
And there can't be many young composers in their 20s who can claim two operas at the Metropolitan New York.
Well, except it would have been much better if both had been a success.
And, in fact, two Pulitzer Prizes you have, too.
Yes, so let's not talk about prizes.
Right. Let's talk about record number three, in fact.
I don't like funerals, and I hope that when I'm buried, I'll be buried without any music or prayers or anything, just thrown into the earth and done away with. But if I must have some music at my funeral, the piece that you're about to hear is my choice, and that is the Schubert Quintet for two cellos in C major. I think it is perhaps one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, and one that always moves me immensely.
Part of the first movement of the Schubert Quintet for two cellos, played by the Juilliard Quartet, augmented by Bernard Greenhouse. Now, you continue to make history, Mr. Menotti, by transferring your next operatic production from the Opera House to Broadway. Now, opera on Broadway, that was indeed a novelty.
Well, actually, it was not my intention to bring opera to Broadway. It was simply an experiment to present opera as a production in itself and not as part of a repertoire. My theory was that if an opera is very well prepared as a play is, it can play every night and it can have an audience for night after night, and one needn't change fare every night the way we do it at opera houses, so then no production is ever faultless. And it was an experiment that was quite successful. We ran the medium for, I believe, 8 months in a small theater, and then in a bigger theater we did the Consul for over a year, and the St. Oblique Street for about 3 months or 4 months.
You like to direct your operas yourself?
Not that I especially like it. I don't like to abandon my operas when they are still infants, and I like to nurse them myself, just like most psychologists think that children should be fed by their own mother at the beginning. So I believe that if a composer can present his own operas, he should do so. And I feel that I'm as good a producer as most people are. As a matter of fact, I feel I'm slightly better. So I like to take care of my young children myself, at least for a while. Then I let them go their
and
own
that,
way.
That takes you about the world.
Indeed.
Produce the new production.
I don't think I will go on doing that much longer because it is very tiring. And at my age, I think it's time that I retire.
There's a short opera that you wrote for television, which is a great standby all over the world at Christmas, Amal and the Night Visitors.
Yes, indeed. That is what helps me to pay all my telephone bills and my electric bills. It is an opera that has given me great joy, especially because it has brought me in contact with children all over the world. And the letters I've received from children as far away as India and Japan, the letters that I treasure, and that I've often reread because some of them are extremely amusing.
Your fourth record we've got to.
The fourth record, well, I'm entering now the operatic field, and I've chosen one of my favorite operas, Pelléas et Mélisande, and I've chosen that opera because, curiously enough, every time I hear Pelléas, although I've produced it myself quite a few times, every time I hear it, I discover something new in it, and it seems to me that it contains so much richness that I never get tired of hearing it.
The interlude between the second and third scenes of Act I of Debussy's Bélias and Mélisande, Ansemé conducting the Suisse Romande Orchestra. I think it was about 20 years ago that you decided to run your own festival in a town in Umbria called Spoleto. How did all that start?
Oh, please don't ask me that, because people have asked me that again and again, and every time they ask me, I give a different answer, because I cannot remember myself why I started.
Why Spoleto?
Well, Spoleto, actually, because it was in the ideal town for a small festival. It had two enchanting theatres, 19th century theatres. Actually, one is almost 18th century theatre. And they were abandoned. The theatre was small enough to be almost like a drawing room. And because Spoleto needed me, and I wanted to be needed.
And you spend several months a year at it, because you have to go and raise the money in the winter as well as the summer.
Well, I don't actually do that. I have sort of a trust now who does that unpleasant job.
And you have plays and concerts and operas and films and ballet and art exhibitions.
But everything. And yes. Also disgruntled spectators and critics.
And you don't allow your own music to be presented?
No, I actually do now.
You do now?
No, I'm not that much of a masochist. I did forbid it for about 14 years. Mm. That is, as long as I was the artistic director of the festival. But then I decided that I wanted to hear some of my own music there, so I vacated my seat, and I let somebody else take over the artistic direction. And now I'm allowed to have some of my music in the festival.
Well, that's good.
I'm only the grandpapa of the festival now, and the vain one.
Now, one thing you must be very proud of, the festival gives you a procession for your birthday every year.
No, heavens, whoever told you that? No. No, they light a few torches, and they send me a few bunches of roses, and that's about all. And it is a legend, all this about the procession.
Record number 5.
I really thought very carefully about what I would take with me to a desert island, and I feel that I should like to take also something that would remind me of my past and something very dear to me, and that is the music of a very dear friend. It's Samuel Barber. Not only because he's a friend, but also because I do admire his music immensely. And I think that his opera, Vanessa, it's one of the most beautiful contemporary operas written. And I think you'll hear the beginning of the quintet.
The beginning of the quintet from the last act of Samuel Barber's Vanessa for which you wrote the libretto, I believe.
Yes, I did.
You live now in these islands.
I live now in Scotland. I bought myself, it has been called different names, a beautiful house, a white elephant, and an ivory tower. I call it an ivory tower.
Near the east coast of Scotland?
Yes, in the East Lothian. Mm. And I love the weather over there, and I love the silence, and I couldn't be happier.
And on this occasion, you've come south to see the first London revival of the Consul by the English National Opera at the Coliseum.
Yes, I was rather taken by surprise, because I believe it was a last-minute decision to revive the Consul. And I was rather nervous at the premiere, because I knew that the production has been put together in a bit of a haste. But I must say I was quite impressed by it, and I thought it is a really very, very exciting and moving production.
Do you compose at the piano?
No, I wouldn't say that I compose at the piano. I compose near a piano. I think on mathematic material, and I sketch things without the piano, and then I like to try them on the piano. And very often the actual sound surprises me at times, and so I correct things and I change them.
What's your next record?
Well, we take a big jump backwards, and we go back to Palestrina, who is another one of my favorite composers. And I think that Palestrina would do very well in a desert island. I don't think one can get tired of Palestrina, especially if one has a good ears and can follow all the intricate design of the part.
Palestrina Motet, Veni Sponsa Christi, sung by the choir of St. John's College, Cambridge, directed by George Guest. How well could you look after yourself on this island? Do you consider yourself a good Robinson Crusoe or not?
I think I could, at this time of my life, I think I could very well take care of myself. When I was younger, I probably couldn't have stood it because... Well, first of all, because I'm a rather amorous person, and I think being alone in a desert town would have driven me crazy.
Would you try to escape?
Well, yes, of course, I would try to escape, I imagine. I mean, don't you think it is instinctive of men to try to escape from anything? I've been trying to escape from myself all my life, so I certainly would... from a desert island. It also would depend how big the desert island is. Yes. I mean, there are so many ifs. If it is big enough, perhaps I would settle there forever. I wouldn't try to escape.
More music, please. Record number 7.
This may be a terrible mistake, but I feel that Wagner should be included for some lazy afternoons when I really feel intellectually lazy and want to bask in some beautiful, sensual sound. I've chosen Tristan because of all Wagner's operas, as the one I love most. And also I do love the voice of Flachstadt, so I've chosen, of course, the second act, which is what probably everybody would choose.
Thank you.
An excerpt from the second act of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, Kirsten Flagstad and Ludwig Suthaus. And now we come to your last record. What's that?
Well, when I came to my last record, I felt really terribly guilty because, first of all, I suddenly realized that I had left Beethoven out and I've left Chopin out and I left, Schumann out. And then there's Mozart. I mean, you can't leave Mozart out. Between Beethoven and Mozart, I think I'd rather have Mozart. So I've taken my favorite opera of Mozart, which is not Don Giovanni, but Nozze di Figaro.
Teresa Berganza as Cherubino in the first act of The Marriage of Figaro. Now, if you could take only one disc of your eight, which would it be?
Oh, dear, what a terrible question. Well, frankly, I would not want to take any discs because the idea of taking one of these beautiful discs with me and having to play it again and again, the same disc again and again, it would absolutely spoil it for me forever. So I would take one disc for maybe play it two or three times and then break it.
Don't break it. Make something useful out of it. I mean, melt it and make a flower vase. Or...
That's a good idea.
And you're allowed to take one luxury.
Well, I imagine perhaps a pack of cards. Tarots, of course.
Tarots?
Yes, of course, because that you can play games with them. I can also read my future and know whether somebody's going to rescue me or not.
And one book, apart from the Bible and Shakespeare, and we don't allow big encyclopedias.
Perhaps a book of philosophy. I mean, other Kant or Wittgenstein or something that would take me a long time to figure out.
A book of philosophy by Kant or Wittgenstein. And thank you, Giancarlo Menotti, for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you, and do come to visit me in my desert island.
I surely shall. Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.